Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and our first lecture in a series of programs addressing California governance reform. This series has been made possible by the generous support of the Irvine Foundation. I'm Dave Iverson, Executive Director of Best Practices in Journalism, and I'm your chair for today. We welcome our listeners on the radio, and we invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our guest for today. Steve Wesley is the State Comptroller of California and serves as the Chief Financial Officer, then, of the fifth largest economy in the world. As Comptroller, Mr. Wesley has the power of the audit over every state agency and is an independent fiscal watchdog for the people of California. He is also a member of more than 50 boards and commissions, including CalPERS, CalSTRS, the Franchise Tax Board, the Board of Equalization, the State Lands Commission, and the major housing commissions of the state of California. Mr. Wesley has more than 20 years of experience in business, government, and education. In the private sector, Mr. Wesley guided the online auction company eBay through a period of rapid growth, including serving as Senior Vice President of Marketing, Business Development, Mergers and Acquisitions, and International Operations. Before becoming active in the internet sector, Mr. Wesley served for 5 years on the faculty at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, teaching public management. Mr. Wesley has also worked on Capitol Hill and for the U.S. Department of Energy. As controller, Steve Wesley tracks funds, audit programs, and monitors the state's cash flow. He has both a BA and MBA from Stanford University. And one more note about Mr. Wesley's duties before he begins his talk today. As preparation for this, I went to the state controller's website, and I discovered there, guess what? An online auction. This is an online auction of unclaimed items from people's safety deposit boxes. And there, you can find such values as these. Walt Disney stamps, an $86 value. 42 Indian head pennies, a $41 value. Altogether, all of the things currently on this website available for auction, total in value, $1,136. So if you want to do your duty as citizens of California, it seems to me that right after today you should go out and participate in this online auction, because then we will be $1,136 closer to solving the fiscal problems of the state of California. It's my pleasure now to introduce Steve Wesley.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I have to start out and tell you, yesterday I spoke to this huge convention. It was the California Bankers Association, and I got there a little late, and the fellow was at the podium, and he was railing against the disrepair in Sacramento, dishonest politicians, and I said, gee, who's going to be introducing me? And they said, oh, the fellow's introducing you right now. And I thought, terrific. I appreciate that introduction much, much more. You mentioned eBay, and as you know, I used to work there, and let me just say, I know the question you're all wondering, how smart could this guy possibly be to leave eBay and go to work for the state of California at this point in time? Please reserve judgment. Since the end of World War II, California has been the engine of American progress in business and industry, arts and culture, science and technology. California has not only led the nation, we've led the world. California is home to 107 Fortune 500 companies, more than any other state. We have the largest concentration of Nobel laureates in the world. In the last 30 years, 38 Californians have won the Nobel Prize, more than any single nation in the world, other than the U.S.
More at Stanford.
Yes.
I had to say that.
And you have the athletic teams to prove it. forgive me.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We're the undisputed global entertainment capital, and California's Silicon Valley has sparked the technological revolution that has changed the world forever. More than anyone else on the planet, Californians have invented the future, from the gold rush to the silver screen, to the silicon chip. But today, We're a state in crisis. We've experienced rolling blackouts, budget crises, credit downgrades, and it seems we're always in the middle of some unprecedented political experiment. And now, we have an Austrian bodybuilder as governor. What next? We face great crises today, but our parents and grandparents faced great crises too, world wars and a depression, and that did not stop them from making the major investments in our roads, hospitals, schools, and in a word, in our future. When weeds tangled their gardens, they planted seeds of opportunity that grew miles into the sky. Today, we face a generational challenge, whether we will make those same commitments to our children. California has always been called the great experiment, and I say to you today, it's time to get back to the laboratory. I think we will answer this generational call if we can just do four simple things. First is reinvest in education. Second is empower the immigrant population of this state. Third is to continue to foster innovation. And fourth is to pass real political reform. So, on the education front, the force behind California's economic engine has been and will always be education. The global economy is getting more competitive every day. The question is, will we make sure that our children can compete in that race? The first company to develop the next big software application or pharmaceutical product takes home the prize. If we educate our workforce properly, California companies will continue to win that race. That means new approaches to education. While our higher education system is world class, UC Berkeley leading that charge, our K-12 education is woefully lagging, and we need to be particularly careful that we're not shortchanging community colleges, the institutions that in many ways are the building blocks of the new economy because they retain workers for emerging trends and the rapidly changing markets. Every year, California community colleges alone serve over 1.6 million students, the largest single educational institution in the United States. They are the breeding ground for the next generation of entrepreneurs. In this time of huge budget cuts, we need to make sure that the advances we've made in education over the last 6 years are maintained. In terms of immigration, if education fuels our economy, then immigrants are the daring new pilots. One in four Californians is an immigrant today, or an immigrant family, part of an immigrant family. California will always be the land of promise for immigrants hoping to make a good life for their families. Even Alan Greenspan has acknowledged that immigrants are playing the key role in driving the California economy faster than the rest of the country. It's the diversity that offers California its greatest strength and in many ways, I believe, is our greatest asset. Today, there's an expectation that immigrants will succeed. And this isn't just a policy position. I'm married to it. My wife's an immigrant from China. Her father, by the way, died tragically just 2 years after they moved here. My wife's mother spoke no English, but she raised five children on her own, by the way, with the help of welfare. But don't feel badly that my wife grew up on welfare. She became a multimillionaire technology executive. The point of this is there are very few places in the world where something like this can happen, where in the course of a generation, you can go from being on welfare to being a multimillionaire business success. That is the extraordinary thing about California, and that is why it's important that we continue to invest in our people. The challenge now is, will we continue to invest in that next generation of immigrants and help prepare them to be as successful as my wife? I want to say a word about capital and innovation. Since I was born in Los Angeles in 1956, California has catapulted from being a middling state to be one of the great economic superpowers in the world. Today, we have a $1.4 trillion GDP, an economy the same size as France, with barely half the population. This means we have a workforce that's twice as productive. And nicer people, too. No, I'm just kidding. It's an extraordinary story. We've done this largely through the success of innovative technology leaders, from Hewlett-Packard and Intel to Cisco and eBay. Today, the big issue, many people are worried about companies outsourcing jobs. And this is a real concern. They're right to be worried. But the answer to this problem, in my opinion, is not to throw up legal roadblocks and tariffs to prevent or try to prevent mature companies from outsourcing jobs. The answer is to make sure that we're still the breeding ground for the next generation of great innovative companies. This means to ensure that there's still a steady flow of risk capital, to streamline the regulatory processes of the state, and to make sure we continue to create a culture that fosters innovation. Let me give you one example. This November, there's going to be a very important bond initiative on the ballot in California to fund stem cell research. This is a critical opportunity for Californians not only to help lead the effort to help find a cure for AIDS, Alzheimer's, juvenile diabetes, and other diseases, but to make California ground zero for what is likely to be the next great technology breakthrough industry. This is the type of opportunity California needs to seize, and I'm strongly supportive of this initiative. Keep an eye on it. This is part of our path to success. Political reform. We have a world-class economy, but do we have a world-class government to support it? Where innovation and education are the engines for growth, California's leadership on political reform propels democracy. California's voters should always have the first and final word. Californians want more choices, more solutions, and less partisan bickering. That's why I've been working on three efforts to reform California's political process, top to bottom. First is to qualify an open primary initiative for the November ballot. Simply put, an open primary allows voters to vote for whomever they choose. This increases voter turnout and is democratizing. There's evidence that open primaries also lead to a more moderate legislature, and having spent the last year watching extreme partisanship grind our political system to a standstill, I can tell you all that having fewer ideologues in Sacramento would be a good thing for every one of you and for the state. Second, we need to reform term limits. Clearly, our term limits are not helping things. They are far too severe and have not worked as intended. In business, we compete for people with experience and knowledge to solve the tough problems before us. In California government, a few years on the job training, and you're out of here. That is no recipe for success. I'm not against all term limits, but they need to amend the current system of 6 years in the Assembly and 8 years in the Senate to at least 8 years in the Assembly and 12 years in the Senate. Third, this state needs independent redistricting. Today, we have 120 legislative districts in California, 80 in the Assembly, 40 in the Senate. Yet in the last election, only 5 of these 120 seats had elections that were decided by less than 10% of the vote. That means we're not having real elections. You would have had a better chance of losing an election as a member of the Supreme Soviet in Russia 20 years ago than you would as an incumbent member of the California legislature. That is not a good thing for democracy. So, you can call the governor the Terminator if you like. Please think of me as the Reforminator. These are the reforms we need to get serious about if we're going to provide the sort of world-class government that will enable California to have the type of success that not only you expect, but the entire world expects of us. Let me suggest that we need to get beyond the stale models held by the traditional left and the right in the political spectrum. You know, the left believes that more taxes are the solution to all of our problems. The right believes we simply need massive tax cuts to starve government and to punish the bureaucrats. Both approaches will seriously undermine California's potential. I think we need a new covenant that says we will invest more in education, infrastructure, and in a word, in our future, but only if government stands up and reforms itself first. Three things. First, we need to get real about the political forms I've mentioned and enact them. That will give the public confidence in us. Second, we need real priorities on what investments government must make and what are the nice-to-haves. What investments provide a real return? Think schools, not prisons. And finally, we need to get serious about cutting waste. Look, we overcame fascism, communism, and totalitarianism. Surely, we can build a better DMV. In terms of cutting waste, my office has been working hard to deliver on the promise of making substantial cuts to government waste. We've set a goal of cutting $1 billion in government waste by doing three simple things. First, we can save at least $200 million by reducing the high cost of providing health care to prison inmates through a managed health care system. While more than 23 million Californians are covered by managed health care plans, such as HMOs and PPOs, inmates get through an unmanaged system, get care through an unmanaged system, costing taxpayers, us, $900 million a year. That's not right. Second, every year, I have a staff of over 200 auditors, and the controller in California serves as the state's auditor. My auditors will save over $200 million for the taxpayers of this state, rooting out waste and fraud. But I have a way for my office to increase that savings to $600 million. If given the power to do performance audits, we can help make sure that taxpayers are really getting the most bang for the buck. Assemblymember Barbara Matthews has introduced legislation to give my office this power. The legislature should act quickly on this bill, and the governor should sign it into law. Again, the financial audit, which we currently have, is the power to determine is money being spent where we say it is. A performance audit is to determine, are we really getting the maximum bang for our dollars that's being spent in education, environmental cleanup, and so on. Third, we're going to save over $100 million this year by cracking down on people who avoid paying their fair share of taxes by using illegal tax shelters. People who use these shelters are essentially making the rest of us pay their share through higher taxes or reduced government services. We're also going after the companies that promote and sell illegal tax shelters. We've just passed new legislation that gives us more teeth when it comes to enforcement. We're now the national leader in cracking down on tax cheats, but there's more work to be done. These simple things will not only help save the state $1 billion, but they will play an even more important role in reinstilling people's faith in government. So, let me conclude here by saying, too often, politicians play to our fears and frustrations. It's time to get beyond that. It's time that we inspire hope and in solutions. People are tired of the political infighting and the gridlock. They just want us to get the job done. I'm proud that the governor and I have set a new tone for working in a bipartisan way to help solve the state's problems. If we can keep this up on issues like workers' comp, electoral reform, we will have done something truly historic. Please know, the governor and I don't agree on every issue. Just the other day, we disagreed. We decided to arm wrestle, best 2 out of 3. Hey, maybe next time he wins. Let me close with a challenge for all of you. Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. said, "The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort, but where he stands in times of challenge and controversy." California is facing a time of challenge and controversy. We've always been known as the trendsetters. Now, We can show the world the way forward by relying on our ingenuity and our innovativeness. I want to invite every one of you to be part of the great debate California is about to have on our budget, on reform, and on making sure we keep our mantle as the technological leader for the world. I hope you will join me in this. Thank you for giving me a chance to speak with you today.
Thank you, Steve Wesley. Now it's the audience's turn. I am Bill Bagley, formerly honorable, I've been known to say, former legislator, former UC regent, presently the alumnus of the year of the University of California. That's transitory, however. And I'm here to moderate the program and ask some questions that you've asked and try to make the program even more interesting by having Steve's comments toward your questions. The questions have a very interesting pattern to them. A lot on Prop 57, 58, a lot on taxes. The last one I'm going to save for the final 2 minutes. First question. If you were in complete control over deciding the state's budget between 1998 and 2003, what would you have done differently? That'll take a half an hour, but try it in three or four paragraphs.
No, I'll tell you exactly what I would have done. I would have stopped the growth in government spending much sooner. An awful lot of people, including myself, saw the tech bubble coming, and we saw it was going to burst. I was working at eBay at the time, and I went literally around the country and said the laws of economics have no more been overturned than the laws of physics. Unprofitable companies will never maintain these valuations. We should have seen this coming, and we should have put the brakes on government spending far earlier than we did. What we've done now is put ourselves in an unfortunate situation where we've signed long-term contracts with public employees, other unions. It's very difficult to take these away. Our budget is now fundamentally out of balance, and the governor and the legislature are going to have a tough time getting it back. No one is going to like the solutions they hear. It's going to be a combination of major cuts and quite potentially some limited tax increases. This won't make anybody happy, but it's what we're going to have to do to put our fiscal house back in order.
Thank you, sir, and that's a good answer. Incidentally, Steve Wesley was just elected controller about a year and a half ago, so you can't blame him for any of the past difficulties, and we shan't. Here's an interesting question. Other than adjusting revenues and expenditures up or down, what are the fundamental and structural changes needed to be done, it says, to the budget and its processes, actually to the entire state government? Fundamental changes of structure.
Well, I think two things come to mind there. One, it's important to know that to get the budget back in balance, you're going to have to do two things: cut spending and potentially raise revenues. But I touched on the third thing government can do a much better job of, and that's cutting waste. As I've said up and down the state, before we even think about potentially raising new taxes, we need to do a better job of cutting waste and collecting some of the taxes that are already on the books. I was one of the first people, and I stood up and said this in Silicon Valley as a former Silicon Valley exec, goods and services being sold over the Internet ought to be taxed like every other part of the economy. That's what's on the books, and we need to be collecting those taxes long before we talk about cuts to schools or increasing new taxes.
Thank you, sir.
One other part
Please.
To that.
We have a lot of time.
One of the other big issues in government, and people get very consumed in, you know, do we tax the rich more? Do we give tax breaks? Equally important to higher taxes or lower taxes is the issue of tax stability. The big problem we're facing now is we go through periods and cycles of huge tax peaks and troughs. And it's important to know that we have jury-rigged. We've set up our taxation system so that it looks like a roller coaster. What we ought to be doing is reevaluating the entire tax code so that we're more based on the taxes that fluctuate least wildly. And the simple reason for this is if you're running a company and you come into a recessionary time or a lean time, you can deal with it. can lay off employees, you can pare back the marketing budget. You can't do that in government. And because you can't respond to the peaks and troughs as quickly, that means we need to set ourselves up for success, not failure, by trying to smooth out our revenue curve, and there are concrete ways to do that.
Thank you, sir. Next question is relatively easy for you, sir.
But I want to... Oh, I worry when I hear that, Bill.
Oh, but I got one here that's going to be even more... It's going to be difficult.
Who's going to win the big game next year, is it?
Let me give some context to these questions. I served in the 60s. Pat Brown was governor. His last budget was $4.6 billion. Today's general fund is $75 billion, putting capital outlay aside. Ronald Reagan, the great man who was going to cut, trim, and squeeze, within 4 years, his budget was $10 billion. It's a 100% increase in 4 years. Prop 13 came along and forced the state to take over all of the, not all, massive amount of local government debt and expenses. And that's part of the reason why the budget has grown so high and so much. In that context of that history, what are we going to do? And secondly, what happens if they don't pass to Proposition? What are we going to do with? And if they don't pass, what are we going to do then? Proposition 58 and 57, 57 and 58.
There are a couple of questions here, and let me try to address each one individually. First, if Propositions 57 and 58 don't pass, I, as the state's chief financial officer, have a contingency plan. We've already hired a financial team of managers. We've already begun to meet with the bond experts on Wall Street, and I will tell you, we're poised to go back to Wall Street literally the next week and go to work on this. But I can also tell you that the polls are trending well ahead on Prop 57 and 58. People have come to realize this is a common sense approach to dealing with what is, by any standard, a tough financial situation. By the way, I would just want to note, you may never see again in our lifetime the consensus of support being built for Prop 57 and 58. Mm-hmm. We have everybody from the state Democratic Party and the state Republican Party endorsing this, from the teachers and the AFL-CIO to the Jarvis-Gann Tax Initiative, the League of Conservation Voters, and frankly, every elected official in the state, from Feinstein, Pelosi, Boxer, there's only one or two people in opposition to this. And it's because of this bipartisan support we've built to do the common sense thing that this initiative has gone from, frankly, being 20 points down in the polls just a month ago to being close to 20% up in the polls. And I will tell you, I think people are going to look back at this and say, you know what? For the last 20 years, we've heard nothing out of Sacramento but bipartisan bickering. Now, for the first time, we're seeing Republicans and Democrats get together, hammer out bipartisan solutions. That's a good thing for every one of you and for the state of California. That's part of why this thing's going to win so resoundingly.
And you've seen Arnold Schwarzenegger, fantastic, incidentally, and Steve Wesley together on television. But
I'm the smaller one.
What will happen... What when you go back to Wall Street, and there's another $10 billion of bonds that were not subject to public approval, it's in the courts, what do you do at Wall Street, number one, and this is a follow-up question, and then assume you get a $10 billion RAN, which is a revenue anticipation note, what happens next? What happens to the state of California?
If this passed or if it's not
If it's not passed. Yeah. When you go to Wall Street saying, please, give us some money.
Here's what happens. If this does not pass, we're on a course to run out of money in about 111 days, June 16th. This is not an academic issue. I'm the state's chief financial officer. We're sending out over $300 million of checks every day. We will run out of money. This is not something anybody should want. If this does not pass, I will be going back hat in hand, subject to Wall Street, which will give us most likely loan shark rates. We'll be paying extraordinarily high interest rates for short-term debt, borrowing in a bit of a fire sale fashion. What the governor is trying to do is take the $20 billion of debt he has inherited and to consolidate it in a common sense way at a time of historically low interest rates.
This is why Moody's, Fitch, and the other Wall Street agencies have come forward and said, you know what, this is a common sense way to get out of what's clearly a tough financial situation. But Mr. Bagley, and I remember when he still was honorable,
thank you, sir.
A friend for 20 years, he raised another important issue. How do you make sure we don't end up here again? And we've talked a lot about Prop 57. Again, a common sense way of consolidating our debt at lower interest rates is married with Prop 58. They both have to pass for either one to take effect. And what the governor and the legislature did here that was so smart is Prop 58 says we will not allow California to be in this situation again. Prop 58 requires three things, and there are three common sense things every Californian ought to support. First, Prop 58 says the legislature must enact a balanced budget. Many of you probably think the state of California must have a balanced budget. Not so. The governor must submit a balanced budget. The legislature frequently does not enact one. That needs to be changed. Prop 58 does that. Second, most of you, virtually every company, has a rainy day fund, a reserve fund for the next time there's a recession, and as sure as I'm sitting here, there's going to be another recession. This creates a reserve fund. That's something every Californian should want. Third thing it does is it says once we have dug ourselves out of this hole, there will never again use long-term borrowing to pay off operating debt. That is a good concept. Unfortunately, we can't do that today, but this prevents us from ever having to do it again once we've dug ourselves out of this hole and put these other measures in place.
Thank you, sir. I've got to go back a little bit in my mind. I was in college when Earl Warren was governor. He had a $75 million rainy day fund. Cost $1 billion today to build a bridge. In 1966, Pat Brown, with that $4.6 billion budget, had about a $400 or $500 million deficit. We in the legislature, and I've been through this budget process for 14 years in the legislature, it was his idea, we went along with it. We advanced the collection of sales taxes. We counted the July tax in June. And that, of course, balanced the budget for the June fiscal year. And some of us proposed that we advance the collection of inheritance tax. We were going to call it, thanks for the laughter, we were going to call it pay now and go later. I had to throw that in. I told you I gave you an easy question. Now here's a hard one. This is from one of the thoughtful members of the audience, and it says, do you support changes in Prop 13 to help solve the state's problems? What changes would you recommend? That's a tough one. It's something that we need to discuss.
I was hoping for some tougher questions today. Many people know Prop 13, passed in 1978, has been the third rail of politics, one of the most popular initiatives in the state's history. But what it's also done is restricted basic tax revenues that have, by anybody's standard, shortchanged our educational system and some of the other basic public services that the state's relied on. Let me just suggest this. There is not going to be any amending Prop 13 in the near future because there is no political support for that. At some point in the future, what I believe will happen is there will be a split roll initiative where people will say, you know what, we want to keep housing taxes or real estate taxes on our seniors at a moderated rate, and that part of Prop 13 will not be touched. But at some point in this state's history, I believe people will review the limits set on corporate taxes, and those may be amended probably in a graduated way over time. So I fully expect that to happen. There is an initiative on the ballot coming up next year that would repeal it almost overnight. That one is going to be tough to pass, but it's something that I think generationally will continue to come up. And I believe at some point many people will come to the same conclusion Warren Buffett has, and that is our current real estate taxation system is not fair, it's not consistent, and it makes no sense.
Oh, I've got to go back again. I debated Howard Jarvis in 1978, saying that Prop 13 would simply cause a
the home rule to become a homey homily, and all of the power would be concentrated in Sacramento. He was president of the Los Angeles County Apartment House Owners Association. That was one impetus for the passage of Prop 13 to reduce apartment owners' taxes. Here's another question for you, changing the subject slightly. Are there any limits to California's population growth?
Well, this is a great question. Most people don't realize we now have over twice the population of New York. We're growing at a rate of 600,000 to 750,000 people per year. You should just expect this state to continue to grow at a dramatic pace. I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know how long this will continue, but I can tell you, for the foreseeable future, this state is going to continue to grow. And the reason is that the free market works. We have a robust economy in this state, and as long as we do, and as long as we're the envy of the rest of the world, you're going to see people coming here in droves. The question is, once we accept that as a simple fact, how do we make sure these people have the best chance to become productive residents of the state? And that is the big issue before government today. But for the foreseeable future, the state's going to continue to grow and to grow rapidly. By the way, this makes it all the more important that we get serious about smart growth planning policies, that we provide real incentives to build more housing in the inner city cores so people can live where they work, and that we provide real teeth in the state planning guidelines that put real pressure on city local governments to build housing. Because today, as many of you know, every city planning director in the state has a huge incentive to bring that extra car dealership and Home Depot to their city. We need bigger incentives for them to build homes than to build Home Depots.
Thank you, sir. Reasonably articulate, this gentleman is. He's
not bad for a Democrat, I think you once told me, Bill.
I love Democrats as a moderate Republican, because if they vote for you, they're worth two Republicans. I voted for Steve Wesley proudly last year. In 1940, California had 6 million people. Nevada had 110,000. During the war, and then with the advent of television, when people in Buffalo saw that it was snowing in their backyard, but the Rose Bowl was being played in the California sunshine, we had the Continental Tilt. That's when people came to California from all over the eastern part of the United States. A little background for you. Here's the next question. Nearly 7 million Californians lack health insurance, and the governor is cutting programs that cover the poor. I don't know about that fact, but that's the statement in the question. How should California address this health insurance crisis?
Well, 2 points here. First, let me just note, many people I talk to say, my God, we're spending more money than we're taking in, and we went through these boom years. Where did all the money go? I don't think, we got any benefit. What the heck's going on in Sacramento? I would just remind you all, educational test scores have been up for 5 consecutive years. The former governor took nearly 1 million Californians and got them basic health care. We've reinvested in roads. 1 mile in every 5 of California roads is now being expanded or repaired. We've been reinvesting in our state. But now we're going to have to pull in the belt to get our budget back in balance. But the point is, the money we spent, much of it, not all, but much of it was spent wisely. Now the question is, we have to make deep cuts. Where do you make those cuts? And many people will say, well, for God's sakes, wherever you make them, just don't make them in education or in health care. Fine for you to say, that's 80% of the budget. And when you have cuts of the size we have, they're going to be made across the board. My counsel to the governor is, do them in as balanced a way as you can. And if you get to the point where there is no more cutting without becoming cost effective, then you need to look at other alternatives, whether it's cutting waste, whether it's short-term taxes, et cetera. People want to see a balanced approach. I often joke about this. The governor stood up in the campaign and said, I'm never going to raise taxes. Okay. I'm never going to cut education. Okay. I'm going to rescind the vehicle license fee. Okay. And people came to me and said, is this possible? Here's the honest answer. No. The governor's painted himself into a corner, and I think he realizes how tough it is going to be now. But that's behind us. He was elected. He was elected by a substantial margin. We need to do the best we can do. Here's the central dilemma facing the governor, but not the governor alone, facing every one of us. We have roughly a $78 or $80 billion general fund operating budget. We have to make roughly $12 billion in cuts to put the budget back in balance. If this was a company, again, you could say, I would do that. We'll lay off some people. We'll cut marketing. We'll do other things. The rub here is in California government today, close to 75% of this budget is mandated. There are things you cannot cut. It's public education that we have set aside in Prop 98 that requires money to go to our K-12 system. It is monies that go to the state college and UC system. It is health care, basic health care, much of which, by the way, goes right in to the coffers in Sacramento and right back out immediately in the form of Medi-Cal payments. These are things that people that are mandated, and by the way, people are highly unlikely to get the two-thirds vote to rescind. So I just want you to know that because the governor is not in an easy or enviable position. As I like to joke, people say, good God, Controller Wesley, I didn't realize this. Who passed these mandates? Please, look to your left and your right. It's us. And by the way, some fellow just got an initiative on the ballot passed last year for after-school sports programs.
Mm-hmm.
Yet another mandate. And I'll tell you, each and every one of them sound as good as Governor Schwarzenegger's did. The rub is when you do them year after year after year, you weave yourself into a straitjacket that makes it very tough to navigate this particular ship of state with. I am sympathetic to the position the governor's in. That's why I am not here to kick him. I'm here to help work with him to solve the state's financial problems. We're in a tough spot. I don't envy him at all. I loved, by the way, the historic perspective that former Assemblyman Bagley put, you know, the former budget deficit, $75 million. Heck, I think the governor spent that much on Hummers. It's a drop in the bucket.
But he no longer pays a high motor vehicle license fee.
Well done.
I've got to ask my own question. In 1949, when I graduated from Berkeley, we had no tuition. An incidental fee in round figures was $60 a year. That paid for health insurance, student body card, a few other things. Tuition today is $6,000. My friends, that's a 10,000% increase. Inflation, and I could document this, has gone up about 1,000% from 1950 till now. 10,000% is not inflation. That's an abject, fancy words, abdication on the part of state government. The general fund in California used to support the University of California by 60%. It's now about 25%. We're no longer a state university. We're a state-subsidized university. You don't have an immediate answer, but in the long run, what can we do for higher education? Understanding community colleges are very important for the wonderful, educated general population. The University of California is important for part of that economic engine. What are we going to do, Steve?
Yeah. Let me just say straight out, in my opinion, the primary reason California has been so successful over the last 50 years is people like my favorite governor, Pat Brown, had the foresight to invest in the UC system, in the state aqueduct, in the freeway system. And the question is, are we going to commit to that same level of investment? Now, public opinion has turned against much public spending, even in education. Education bonds always used to be a slam dunk. And let me just say, the other absolutely important initiative on the ballot next Tuesday is Prop 55, every one of you should go out and support this basic investment in rebuilding the state's deteriorated schools. This is something every one of us should be behind. The simple fact is, people are less supportive of public education for two reasons. The first, we have an aging population, and for whatever reason, seniors show that they are less interested in investing in education than they used to be. I cannot change the aging population, or politically, I'm not going to. The other part of the equation, though, is what I referred to in what I think is this new covenant. I think people feel that the dollars they've invested over the last 20 years have not been spent as wisely as they should. And rather than continuing to come back and say, more money, more taxes, I think we as publicly elected officials and throughout government need to stand up and say, you know what? The buck starts with us, and that means tightening our own belts. That means milestones and objective standards for public services that we provide, and it means doing a better job of cutting waste. If government and elected officials will take greater responsibility, I think we can break the logjam and get people feeling an awful lot better about the monies they invest in this state's future.
Thank you, sir. There are a lot of questions coming up about why not raise taxes. So, with one sentence on my part, preface, why not raise taxes? Incidentally, I love to pay deductible taxes. I told this before the program to Steve. When you cut the motor vehicle license fee, which is an in-lieu property tax collected by the DMV, by $4 billion, you have decreased $4 billion worth of federal income tax deductions. And at an average rate, which is low, of 25%, you've given the federal government $1 billion. So, Steve, I like to raise taxes that are deductible. What do you like to do?
I could not be in more agreement with you on this issue.
The simple answer, though, is that Californians, by and large, don't want to see taxes raised. It's fascinating for me as a Northern Californian. Everyone I go to, everywhere I go in the Bay Area, people say, this is an easy one. Go raise taxes. And everywhere I go in Southern California, in the Central Valley, where two-thirds of the population lives, says, are you people mad? That's the issue we need to solve for. So again, on Prop 57 and 58, let me just say it's fascinating. Everybody, every major constituency group you know has come together and said it's a smart thing. There's only two, barely more than two people I know that are opposed to this as public officials, and it's fascinating what they say. One is on the far right and says, the answer to this problem is easy. We just need to cut government 16 or 18% across the board, cut everything. It's a no problem. I don't like government. Who'd miss it? And the simple fact is, because so many of these programs are mandated, you can't cut government 18% across the board. There's no public support for cutting education or basic health care 18%. And if you leave those two programs out, roughly 75 or 80% of the budget, that means you'd be cutting everything else 80%. That is a non-starter. Now, we move to the far left. People are saying the mere opposite thing. We ought to just solve this problem right now. I don't want to leave any debt for my kids. $10 billion in new taxes. This problem goes away, and it's the right thing to do. Friends, there is no support for a $10 billion tax increase. These two proposals, while they appear to different extremes on the spectrum, are dead on arrival. If you want to make government work in the real world, where I go to work every day in Sacramento, you have to have balanced solutions with bipartisan support. That's what the governor and I are trying to do. Anything else, frankly, is going to leave you in gridlock because the ideologues have been poking each other for too long, leaving us with a budget stalemate every year, which leads to our bonds being downgraded, which is not the direction this state ought to go. I'm looking to fix the problems.
Thank you, sir. One quick comment on my part. I can't resist. Been in office too long, put a microphone in front of me, and I speak a little bit. The fuel tax is the only tax in the history of the world, perhaps, that's gone down because it's taxed per gallon. I used to get 10 miles to the gallon. I now get 30 miles to the gallon. I'm paying much less fuel tax today than I was 30 or 40 years ago. So you could, I don't want to use the word increase. You could simply ratchet up the fuel tax and pay for all of this infrastructure that some people refuse to support. Now, having said that, change the subject again. The devil is in the details. What would you change? How would you change the present system of redistricting?
Oh, boy. Let me speak to the issue of fuel tax first.
Please do.
Come back to redistricting. First, I'm proud to have the one Republican in the state of California who's willing to talk about sensible tax increases. I think Bill may be the only one. You should just note, in the legislature, the president of the Senate has said any Republican elected official who mentions the word taxes, I will have that person thrown out of office at the next primary election or else.
Not the president of the Senate, the minority.
The minority leader. Forgive me. Brutal.
Johnny Burton forgives you also.
Yeah. This is the sort of ideological brinksmanship. It's tying this state's hands together, but that's why we're not getting to the common sense solutions. Next point here, you should just know we have one of the smallest gasoline taxes of any state in the country, but realistically, I just want to say if there's one thing Californians are passionate about, it's their cars. And after the entire elected officialdom of the state of California watched what happened with the car tax, watched a popularly elected governor thrown out of office in only the second recall in U.S. history, elected officials are going to be a little leery to touch that one. Why? Because the people, by and large, don't want it. So it may be a great policy solution. We need to navigate around whether it's a realistic one. Now, you had the question about redistricting.
Sir, how would you change it? What's the process by which it could be changed?
Here's what needs to happen. You need an initiative to go on the ballot. Let me just tell you, the odds of having the elected officials themselves have a third party change redistricting as opposed to them doing it, locking themselves into the same gerrymandered districts, is nil. They've got a great deal going. The irony, and every one of you should realize this, I know why the Democrats did the deal. My party has a huge advantage in the Assembly and the Senate. They wanted to lock in a majority lead in perpetuity. The stunning thing is the Republicans looked at this and said, what the heck? We'll lock ourselves into a minority stature forever as long as we get to keep our seats. We're employed. We love it. That's a stunning thing. The answer is to get the public to put an initiative on the ballot that says at the next decadal census, when redistricting occurs, that it be done by an impartisan third-party panel. Whether it's judges or an appointed group doesn't matter to me. The key is you don't want it in the legislature's hands because they have a vested interest. You understand this in almost every part of society. You don't want people with a vested interest sitting on juries. You don't want people with a vested interest who are judges on other issues. We need an impartial group of people who are deciding how our legislative seats should be redone. But by the way, just a historic aside, because Bill, it brings so much color to this, we've had this once or twice in our history, and Assemblyman Bagley can correct me if I'm wrong, but it led to essentially the same party makeup. There was no dramatic change. It just gave us sensible districts that provided, I think, a more balanced legislature.
There was an initiative. I've always said beware of ideologues and beware of initiatives, but sometimes you need initiatives to force the ideologues to stop running initiatives. There was an initiative, and it was opposed by the parties, and it didn't pass. It would have put district court judges, retired judges, in charge of redistricting. The courts did this once. They were forced to. I went through 5 decennial censuses in 14 years in the legislature. It's the most diabolical process you can imagine. People are cutting off your head to save their own seats. But now they've vested all these seats in the far left and the far right. We have another question, interesting one. Your comments, Steve, on Proposition 56.
We've covered 57 and 58. I urge a strong yes vote on those. We've talked about Prop 55, which is the education bond initiative to reinvest in the state school system. Absolutely vote yes on that. Prop 56 is probably the most complex initiative on the ballot because it does two very different things. First, it says that we should reduce the number of votes it requires in the legislature to pass a budget from 2/3 to 55%. Let me just tell you, as the state's controller, that is a good thing. We don't want the budget tied up every year. That is precisely what leads to gridlock and having our bonds downgraded. But it does something else. It says that the legislature can enact new taxes with only a 55% majority instead of a 66% majority. This frightens people. It gives them great concern that there will be huge tax increases. On balance, I've supported the initiative. It's looking tough in the polls, but it's two very different things that have been patched together, and I know there's a great deal of confusion about this, especially because of the media, but I'm advocating a yes vote on all four propositions.
We are almost out of time for our program, mindful of our radio audience, and I have saved two questions for last. Incidentally, while I still have 30 seconds, this is a most articulate person, brand new in government, fresh face, wonderfully informed, only been in office for a year and a half. I compliment you, sir.
Well, thank you.
Now my question, two of them, in this order. What are the odds that Arnold will not run for re-election in 2006? Next question. Are you planning to run for governor in California in 2006?
Well, I'll answer at least one of those questions. I have a hunch, and look, no one knows. No one knew that he was even going to run last time, including his own campaign staff. My gut is the governor is going to stand up, try to do the right thing, not worry about the polls, and I have a gut feel he probably won't run again. I just have to think that this job is a lot tougher than perhaps he ever realized. In terms of what I will do, heck, I'm going to take your counsel and do what you tell me, just like always, Bill. No, let me just say one last
thing. I'll pay your filing fee, sir.
Bill Bagley is someone who's a legend in California politics. The reason for that is he represented a civility in government that is now lost. Mm-hmm. I don't agree with Bill Bagley on every issue, but he was emblematic of something that this state government desperately needs back, and I'm trying to help recreate what Bill Bagley did for this state for 20 years.
Yeah,
thank you for having me.
We did have civility in those days. Thanks, Steve Wesley. Thank you very much, California State Controller. We thank our audience and our radio audience. And we now apparently are supposed to close this by banging the gavel three times. Thank you all.